Welcome to the Alien Faculty Incubator podcast series. Need help upgrading your academic development in the modern scholarly age? Well, we're here to present professional development content from worldwide experts in the realm of health professions education. Take a listen and join us in the conversation now. Hello, everybody. This is Teresa Chan. And I have with me here Robert Cooney and Jonathan Sherbinow. We're here to talk about competency-based medical education and a lot of the principles regarding that for the faculty incubator with the Alien.com group. So I'm going to start the discussion by asking you guys to talk a little bit about your experiences right now with CBME or competency-based medical education and kind of chat a little bit about what your first thoughts of that whole process has been like.
Well, Teresa, I'll jump in. So it's pretty exciting to be a part of this month and also an opportunity to kind of share some of our experience. I'll admit that we're very early in the process of conversion of all 68 disciplines, so that's specialties and subspecialties in Canada, to a CBME model. We have our first cohort who has just gone live as a pilot. And for emergency medicine, we are going live to a CBME model in 2018. I chair the specialty committee, which is, in American translation, kind of an amalgam of the ACGME, ABMS, ABEM, all in one. And we are in the process of trying to convert over all the standards for accreditation, all the residency design, and coming forward will also be the standards for maintenance of certification for anyone who's a specialist in emergency medicine. So our experience is that it seems really exciting in principle, but we're holding our breath and maybe changing our scrubs a couple times as we try to struggle with what are all the operational considerations? How do you actually make it work? How do you get residents to the right rotation at the right time that's right for them? And that's the part that we were wrestling with for the last year and a half, and that's what we're trying to work on in the coming year and a half.
Okay. And Rob, yourself?
So I would echo that the operationalization of the principles has been kind of exciting and kind of frustrating at the same time. We don't have quite the alignment in the American system when you look at the AAMC from the medical school component moving into the ACGME with graduate medical education and then the ABMS afterwards. And they're attempting to align that trajectory from medical school into practice, but we have a long way to go yet.
So let's just strip this down to the core elements again and kind of bring it back to basics. I think it's important to make sure we're all on the same page. So what would you two consider the essential elements of what define a CBME curriculum? Like what makes something CBME versus not?
I think first things first, you need to have an idea of what a competent emergency physician looks like holistically, all of the skills that they need, and then you can work backwards from there to define the different competencies and subcompetencies that make up that whole. And then from there, you need to have a reliable assessment system that says that if we see this type of behavior or activity, then we know that they are meeting that competence. I know initially when I was introduced to CBME, I was a little bit kind of frustrated because I thought, why are we just going for competency? Why aren't we going for mastery? And it's kind of a false dichotomy because the mastery level outcomes you would be competent in.
So I'll jump in, Therese, and say that we think that CBME is a new thing. It's really not a new phenomenon. It's kind of a building on the whole outcomes of movement in education that was adopted in kind of K-12 and then in high school, secondary school training in the 60s and 70s. As far back as like late 70s, early 80s, there was a couple of position papers written by a few giants in medical education from the WHO saying CBME is the way that we should seek to move forward. I would say that there are lots of things that get labeled CBME that may not meet a threshold for being called CBME. Right now, if you're an education scholar or researcher, the guaranteed way to get your paper published is to slap the CBME jargon title somewhere on your paper and ascribe it that way. The four things I think of are, you have a framework of all the competencies. So if you believe that an outcomes-based approach to education is the way to go, then you start with the end in mind and say, what are the graduate abilities that we need to observe and assess in order to send you out of residency training into unsupervised practice? So that's number one. So you have a framework that says this is what a specialist in emergency medicine can do at graduation. Two, you need some degree of progression of ability. Our current model basically throws you into residency. We, in an ad hoc way, try to make sure that you're moving forward, and sometimes we have uncomfortable conversations with our residents, and other times we say, hey, you're outperforming where you should be, but there's no standardization or systematic way to say you're tracking on a trajectory that will lead to success. So you need some kind of progression system, and in Canada, we're building a model that says we have these four stages of residency, and there are milestones or gates that you need to pass through in order to move to the next stage. And we anticipate you to move at this rate, and if you're not hitting those milestones or moving through that gate, then that becomes a flag early on to allow us to, say, small R remediation. Likewise, if you push through really quickly and say, wow, we're going to advance you much quicker so that you can optimize that entire envelope of time that you have been funded for training. I think number three is that you need some idea of tailored learning, and this is interesting, but it becomes a real logistical challenge. So when I say tailored learning, I mean no one ever goes to academic half day. So no one ever goes to conference or in Canada academic half day and sits in a group of 50 to 70 people and imagines I'm learning at the exact same pace as everyone beside me. And I think it's true also in our clinical environment. So we should be cognizant of the idea that everyone learns at different paces depending on their ability, previous experience, their ability to grasp concepts, whether they've missed foundational items on which this new knowledge needs to be built. And so we need to have ways that says, I'm going to give you more exposure to these clinical experiences because we realize that's an area that you need to focus on so that you can maintain your trajectory. And then we're going to look at a resident B and say, you know what, you don't need that same type of exposure. You need this different type of exposure. It could be as simple as saying, in the emergency department, we want you to have an excess exposure to some of our pediatric cases or our mental health cases. Or it could mean as formal as saying, we think you would benefit from more planned intensive care medicine rotations in the MICU or the SICU, et cetera. Then the last bit is a system of assessment. And I think, Teresa, we're going to talk about that a bit more. But essentially, a program of assessment would say you have multiple ways to sample what your resident is actually doing in the authentic environment. It doesn't mean we do an in-training exam and then have kind of an end-of-rotation report, and then we give you a big written and oral exam at the end of your training. It means that we capture what you're doing with multiple data points from multiple observers over a longitudinal period, and then we have a process that allows us to aggregate that data and to make some kind of collective decision at the level of the residency saying, you know what, with all these data points, we're making a great case for this resident to be on target, to be below the trajectory, or to be above trajectory, and then to make a decision about how do we need to modify and change their learning experience. So I'd summarize and say, you need a competency framework, you need progression, you need tailored learning, and you need a program of assessment. I think if you have all of that, or a pretty close approximation to that, I think it's acceptable to hang the label of saying your curriculum is CBME approved.
But there are a lot of skeptics out there that kind of talk a little bit about graduate medical education or postgraduate medical education has been fine up until now. Why do we have to go to outcomes? Why do we have to do all this accounting? What's your take on why do we need to change?
I think that we are beginning to see that things aren't fine. And by beginning, I mean we've got a decade worth of data now that shows that we're not meeting the outcomes that the public is expecting of us. You can look back at the To Err is Human report, which I believe was published in 1998, and then carry some of that data forward through the whole quality improvement movement. And back in 2010, I believe, in the New England Journal, where we showed that, you know, in 10 years, we haven't moved the needle at all on making care safer for our patients. And when I first saw that report, you know, I thought about the fact that we're probably catching more things now that we're more aware of what's going on. But I got to see Tom Naska talk about it, and he made the very good point that in practice, a physician will probably last about 30 years. And so in the 10 years that that study took to perform, we should have turned over one-third of the physicians in practice. And if we aren't moving the needle at all, that means that physicians aren't graduating from medical school or from residency prepared to make those changes to their own practice and improve the quality outcomes for our patients. And so I think that's one of the major drivers. There have been other studies that have looked at how where you train influences how you practice for many years post-graduation. And so we definitely need to re-examine the skill set that we're giving our learners once they enter practice unsupervised.
Yeah, I think some of those papers, if you can find them, would be great to throw up on the faculty incubator.
Be happy to.
Account. That'd be great. Jonathan, how do you address the skeptics?
I think the argument about meeting up to public and societal demand is important. I think the argument of meeting our patients' demand of patient safety is important. I'd actually add a new argument around meeting and helping the demands of our learners and our faculty at the same time. Right now, our organization of our curriculum is based around time. You know, the most important educational tool we have is a calendar. That's crazy to me. Imagine if we can implement CBME in an effective way and we give very granular, precise direction to a faculty as to here's the shared mental model of what the junior learner should be able to do in your clinical and emergency department. Imagine if we gave that same kind of data to these really bright trainees who are anxious and hungry to progress as quickly as they can so that they can take all the slack out of the system where they feel like, you know what, I'm doing this rotation, I just feel like I'm spinning my wheels, waiting for the calendar to turn over so that someone can give me their ad hoc understanding of what it means to be a more intermediate or more senior learner. So if we can provide more explicit direction, the thresholds or the milestones we want people to take, if we can implement a system where you're getting sampled about your performance, which leads to more conversations in the environment with comments such as, I see you doing this, continue to do it, I'd like you to modify this other element so that you can move to the next step. I think the big hope or promise for the learner and faculty is that a system that's worked well, like I think our graduates over the last 30 plus years in emergency medicine have been outstanding, our specialties really evolved. But there's efficiencies and there are improvements into the educational delivery that we can bring. And I think changing the contextual design using CBME as our organizing framework will allow us to do that. I think it will give more description to frontline faculty, more description to our learners as to where they're going, because we're going to provide them with a very granular roadmap.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you're saying there. I think one of the things that I've thought about it increasingly is that with education, it's not a population-level science. It's an NF1 experiment repeated endlessly. And so I think what we have to try to reframe is that we want to make each individual learner as good as they possibly could be at the beginning of their practice and the end of their training, so that their first patient, that idea of patient zero, is as well cared for as humanly possible. And I think that if we reframe that, yeah, sure, we might have been having good enough doctors until this point, but did we have great doctors? Did we have amazing doctors? We have doctors that could have been as good as anyone coming out the gates as our system could possibly foster. And I think that that's where we need to try to reframe the thinking. We're not just trying to cookie cutter a bunch of people out and put them as cogs in the machine. They are individually thinking, brilliant people. Let's not make them less brilliant. Let's not hinder their growth. Let's not constrain them in any way, but rather really jumpstart their careers.
If I could just pick up that thread with just like an anecdote. So I go and talk to a lot of people about competency-based medical education as someone associated with the Royal College. I've had this unique and 100% consistent signal that anytime I'm in a group of program directors and I ask the question, have you ever sent one of your trainees forward to the certification exam while you closed your eyes and pinched your nose, thinking and imagining that they were not going to read the standard. Uniformly, there's every program director puts up their hand. That doesn't mean they're doing it frequently, but they've done it some time in the past. And I think a new model that says we will put in an operational framework that ensures in order to leave an exit residency and enter into unsupervised practice will mean you've actually demonstrated in a meaningful, longitudinal way that you've achieved all of the competencies. You can do all of the abilities of a specialist in emergency medicine. I think that is perhaps the thing that links best education to best patient outcomes and links different driving factors from a societal and from a profession as to why we're changing medical education.
So I think that you mentioned this before, Jonathan, so I'll start with you, but maybe if you could very quickly kind of put together again the idea of what programmatic assessment means.
Sure. One of the Journal Club articles, I think the one that we're going to be posting probably today, is going to be on the McMap experience. That's the beta version of a programmatic assessment for emergency medicine that, Teresa, you have spearheaded here at McMaster. So we'll put that up, paper. It's in the syllabus right now. Essentially, up until we developed a programmatic assessment system here at Mac, the way that we knew our learners were tracking is we'd ask at the end of our rotation their supervisor to fill out a really long paper document that uniformly had a pen that started in the corner and went right down saying Chiefs, and then they would get a little nervous and say, oh, that doesn't seem consistent, so I'm just going to jog here to the left at whatever line I found myself at, which is needs improvement, and I come back because they're doing fine and finish them. And that evaluation would happen months after the rotation, would not facilitate any kind of true transition or challenge to the learner. So we had that. We would do an in-training exam, which was MCQs, which is a really great way to determine if someone can manage an emergency department or resuscitate a critically ill patient. Then we'd basically send you to the Royal College exam. We'd do a couple oral exams on the way to make sure that you could talk about how to do a thoracotomy, having never actually watched you do one in a simulated or in an authentic environment. A program of assessment says that you have a whole bunch of ways to capture what you're doing. You still have things like MCQ exams. I think they're really effective for asking knowledge questions, like what's the differential for a bullous dermatologic lesion? Really easy ways to ask an MCQ question or a short answer question. We still have practice orals because we want to work through the diagnostic reasoning and the clinical management of rare presentations with our trainees. But we've added a lot of work-based assessment where we provide our faculty with these force function mini snapshots where they observe probably about 2 to 3 minutes of actual practice once during an emergency department shift. They have a scoring template that teaches them what to look for and how to answer. And we are collecting hundreds of data points on our residents in terms of how they actually function in the emergency department every year. We take all that data, we mix it together, and we can produce trajectories, so these curves showing where you are compared to where your peers are and compared to where past cohorts are. And we look at that slope and say, wow, you're doing really well, or we need to address some element of your practice. And ultimately, we take all that data and we go to our competence committee, which is a subcommittee of our residency training committee, and they look at it basically like a jury looks at it and says, we have all this data based on the argument presented here, much like you would in a court of law. We think that there is strong evidence to suggest that this trainee is on track and we would like to promote them to the next level, or we think there's evidence that they're exceeding their trajectory and we'd like to advance them forward beyond what would be expected. Or we think that there are some areas that we want to address now, early in training, so that we don't have that train wreck that comes within the final 6 months of residency training where we all scratch our head and say, we probably knew this was coming, we never paid attention, now we have to put all the pieces together in a very tight time window.
I'm going to jump in a little bit. I think another challenge that we're going to have in our assessment programs is a significant need for faculty development. At least when you look at the American system in emergency medicine, 23-some milestones with, you know, 5 different levels and sub-competencies beneath those. And we have faculty who aren't even competent in some of these milestones. One of my favorites to pick on is ultrasound, because it is a newer technology within emergency medicine, and some of our more senior faculty have kind of ignored it in terms of their clinical practice, deferring it to some of the newer faculty. And so they aren't capable of assessing what they themselves are not competent in. And so we have to be able to identify our faculty members' weaknesses and bring them up to the competency standards as well as the residents in order for them to make the proper assessments.
Yeah. I mean, I think that brings up some of the frame of reference literature out there by Jennifer Cogan and Eric Humble. They've talked a lot about the idea of a faculty member bringing more or less their own baggage, but their own frame of reference about what is good and what is not. Like, if I'm not a very good charter, then anyone who charts better than me, like, if someone has better handwriting than me, I think they're amazing at charting and they're very organized, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that would be compared to a criterion gold standard, that it would necessarily be good charting. I think that you see that in other things as well, whether that's the way that you manage the team during a resuscitation. Some people are very finessed at that compared to even their cohort and their supervisors. And some people, I think that that's going to be one of the biggest conversations, is that how does CBME affect the faculty that are trying to teach in a way that they never learned?
I think your point's right on the money. I think that's the thing that scares me the most. I think we'll need to adopt new models of faculty development. I've never been convinced that taking busy faculty away from the clinical environment to put them voluntarily, which means you already have the people who are doing it the best, into a classroom to sit around and talk about stuff, is a particularly efficient way. So I think we'll need new models. I think it will be a considerable element to address. I would point out that although we are introducing new concepts, and I think there is faculty development around some of these terms, such as, and this is what we're struggling with in the Facubator, like what the heck is a work-based assessment, or what is a competency, or how does that, what does that mean, or these EPAs, how do I actually use them? All those things, like this whole alphabet soup of medical lexicon jargon nonsense. I think there's a bit of that. But I think more than anything, what CBME is doing is, as we reorganize medical education, we're kind of exposing some of the assumptions we assumed in previous generations, that faculty were using best practices to teach, faculty were competent in all areas of which they were supervising, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this is not necessarily introducing a crisis in faculty development, it's simply exposing some of the ongoing needs that have always been there.
The next question that we have is the idea of time. Now, I think the greatest fear is that in CBME, time is no longer kind of like the currency that we're going to be thinking in, and that some people are going to need like unlimited amounts of support, and some people are going to need less time, hopefully, to offset that. But how does time work into this? Can we ever really give up that calendar, Jonathan?
No. So it's a bit of a unicorn to imagine that any funding agency is going to say, you know, take your time. You know, we'd be happy to pay you for an indefinite residency training period. The model that we're adopting in Canada for all of our disciplines is that the envelope of funding remains the same. So with the very rare exception, and it happens currently, though some residents, a very tiny minority, might have an additional funding year. And currently we have that for one of our trainees in our program here. But that will be the exception and certainly never the norm. So the envelope of funding remains consistent. But how you function within that envelope of funding will be tailored, individualized way. So time is no longer the organizing construct, meaning I spent 1 month in the CCU, the cardiovascular care unit, where I learned how to manage critically ill cardiac patients. At the end of that 1 month, it's no longer determined that you're competent to do that simply because you showed up every day for 30 days in a row. The new marker is, at some point during your allotment of time in the CCU, can you demonstrate that you have achieved all of it? And if you achieve all of it, then you probably continue with that rotation, but you are challenged with more senior, higher level responsibility. If at the end of your month you haven't achieved everything that you're attempting to work on, then at some point your residency director is going to need to flag and say, you know what, we need to send you back for another experience there to make sure that you meet all the competencies necessary to be a specialist emergency physician looking after cardiovascular emergencies. So it's really a hybrid model, I think. But we use time as an independent variable to give you more exposure to your tailored learning rather than time as your organizing construct. When the calendar rolls over, you must have, because you were there for 30 days, you must have learned and can do everything that's required of you.
Rob, what's your experience been like in terms of residency programs now in the U.S., now that there are the milestones, there are the EPAs? How is time factoring in now? Are people still setting things by calendar years?
When you look at the milestones, a lot of those can be broken down across rotations. And so you may get components of some of the milestones on one rotation and other components on another rotation. So we haven't really gotten to the level of individualized rotations yet. And then we have also always had some component of electives built in. What we may see going forward is some of those electives may be repossessed in order to give learners that extra time that they may need to master some of the competencies if they're unable to do that, as Jonathan said, during their already assigned times.
that flexibility may be a privilege as opposed to a standard component of everyone's education.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Okay.
All right, so the last thing is a little bit of a primer, I guess, and a push for this month's assignment, I guess. I think that I'd like to talk a little bit about the faculty incubator assignment for this month, which is basically challenging the teams of three in the faculty incubator to kind of put together a proposal for what they could do this year to align their program a little bit more to a CBME model. How do you think this will be useful?
Our Canadian programs know that we're not going to turn the switch on what their day-to-day functioning of their residency program looks like for another, about a year and a half. Now, I would say that all of our program directors and the faculty within those programs are very innovative. One of the motivators to be a teaching faculty is the opportunity to experiment and to change and to bring best practices. And my message has never been just hang tight, do nothing for the next 18 months, and then we'll give you a mad scramble to get your program off the ground. I do caution people to say, try not to reinvent the wheel. So for in Canada, we will be providing certain technologies that will be required and standardized. A good example is we are producing an e-portfolio that will be common amongst all emergency medicine programs. So if you are a computer programmer at a Canadian university, then stop programming your own portfolio, because that's going to be frustrating when there is a force function in the Canadian environment in 18 months that says, you must use this technology. But there's lots of ways that you can start preparing for that change, or if you're in the midst of transitioning, as many of the ACGME programs are, to start adopting best practices that are aligned with the goals. So a good example we've already talked about is faculty development. I'm getting our faculty on board with, what do we mean by EPAs, work-based assessments, competence, competencies? What does all of this mean? And a good argument for why are we doing it? It's not simply we had nothing better to do and decided that we were going to wreck everybody's life with all this additional information. I think the second thing would be is, how are you using EPAs and what does your assessment system look like? Is it authentic in terms of observing what individuals do in the workplace? And can you start in very small steps to use some of these tools in a way to increase the sampling over time by multiple assessors to show what your residents are doing? And then how is your competency committee performing and functioning? And so I'll tell you that Teresa and I will be happy to share some of the work-based assessment instruments we have. They're free through a Creative Commons license, downloadable at iTunes, and we'll put the link to that in Slack. And you can see the paper that describes a little bit of what we've done with McMap. And if you ping her or I, we can talk a little bit about that.
A couple of words that I really like that Jonathan said. So the first one is small. Within the American system, again, we have 23 different milestones, each with their own subcompetencies. And each one of those will have to be incorporated into a system of assessment. And you don't have to take them all at once. So identify one that they believe they can easily implement. And then the other word that I really liked that Jonathan said was iterative. You know, you're not going to get this right out of the gates. So play around with what you believe is a competency construct, run it through the different groups, and then come back together and see, you know, do you think this will work? Will this not work? Or better yet, try it with your learners and see how it actually applies in the real workplace environment. And then when it's not working, come back and make some small changes again and roll it out.
I think one of the greatest opportunities actually this month is to be playful with things and try to think through, let's say you have milestone X, let's say it's interpersonal and communication skills one, and there's a sub-milestone and you really want to see if someone is really good at communicating with patients and families in this way. How does that map back, but how do you actually capture that at the bedside? I think thinking through that experiment just in a little way helps you kind of really think, okay, what is it that we do every day and how can we give people feedback to improve on that practice every day?
For the members who were already at the design thinking workshop, some of those skills that they learned there can easily be applied to this type of work as well.
I think the authenticity part really can be driven by, I think there was a Wall Street Journal article about an assistant vice principal or something like that following a little student round in grade 5 or 5th grade. I think that that's something that you could consider doing even just for a part of a shift. Come on in and see what your residents are experiencing when they go on a shift even just for a couple of hours, just to see if you can get a better sense of when there are opportunities where they can be assessed or can display their competence to somebody. Okay, well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for everything, and just now on Slack. But hopefully we can look forward to sharing some ideas on how we can kind of transition everyone a little bit more towards CBME. I know that we've all been asked to operationalize that, but I know that we've all been asked to operationalize some aspects of these CBME curricula, but everybody's probably at a different place, and no one's really truly perfected everything so it's seamless and easy to do. So I think that we can all share our experiences, the horror stories, but also the successes, and really kind of maybe up the ante in terms of what we can bring to each other and sharing our faculty knowledge.
And that's a wrap for another great podcast from the Alium Faculty Incubator. We would love to hear your thoughts and feedback. Follow us on Twitter at Alium Fac, at A-L-I-E-M F-A-C.